This is Talk of the Nation. Neil Conan is away. I'm Korva Coleman. Are we really aware of how ever-present surveillance cameras are in our daily lives? Well, here's an example of my morning commute through those electronic eyes. It starts with lunch money. Of course, I gotta have that. So the first lens picked me up as I stood at my bank's ATM. From there, on my daily commuter train ride downtown, I passed under the station's ever-vigilant cameras, my second TV appearance today. Walking out of Union Station on Capitol Hill, I starred in one of the City of Washington's security cameras. And finally, as I entered the NPR lobby, our own security system took a good look at me. Four cameras in a morning's outing that I know of. Not too bad for a radio girl, huh? Well, of course, one expects the greater Washington area to be a well-photographed city. But the use of closed-circuit cameras is actually a fact of life throughout the United States, and the mind behind the lens isn't that quiet security guard anymore. Increasingly, it's now a computer. This month, the city of Chicago announced it will network its more than 2,000 existing surveillance cameras and further install software that can identify potentially suspicious behavior. If you're a little too interested in the wrong building, if you accidentally leave your purse on the wrong park bench, the eyes of Chicago will be upon you. Public video surveillance calls up thorny questions of privacy versus security, public trust, and public good. This hour, we'll tackle that new technology and the old questions. Later this hour, we'll move from the streets to the runway. The federal government's attempts to fine-tune its terrorist watch list means that your passenger data may soon be in government files. But now the evolution and the effectiveness of public video surveillance. We'd like to hear your stories. If you've had experience with these systems as an operator or as a subject, please give us a call. Are there security cameras in your neighborhood? And is life better because of them? Do you have questions about what the technology is capable of? Please join our conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And, of course, our email address is totn@npr.org. With us now from Chicago is Ron Huberman, the Executive Director of the Chicago Office of Emergency Management and Communications. It runs the city surveillance cameras. Mr. Huberman, welcome to our show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on, Korva. How are you?
I'm well. Mr. Huberman, Chicago's had some of these cameras for years. So with this new technology, just what will these cameras do that they can't do at this moment?
Sure. You know, Korva, there's a few different things we're doing with our cameras which we think are pretty unique and interesting. First of all, we're going to be applying intelligent software and technology to the cameras. And many of the things you opened up with your show are the same things that these cameras will truly be able to do. They will be able to identify abandoned packages that might be left around critical areas. They'll be able to identify behavior that is suspicious and automatically alert an operator. Another way that these cameras are going to be innovative is they're going to be fully integrated into the city's 911 center. So that now in the city of Chicago, when the system is operational, if you dial 911, the person on the other end of the line will automatically get an image of the camera that's closest to the origin of the 911 call.
Now, this actually sounds not so much terrorist prevention efforts. This sounds like crime prevention.
That's absolutely right, Korva. You know, when the mayor announced this initiative, he really laid it out as having dual use. And the mayor announced it as being able to not only help us with crime prevention, but also being a tool to help with terrorism. And, you know, and the mayor actually went ahead and said that it's a whole new way to deliver government service.
A whole new way to deliver a government service. How will this prevent, say, another Timothy McVeigh from attacking a federal building?
You know, it's potentially through a lot of different means it would have that capacity. It would be able to identify a specific vehicle that might be suspicious that's traveling in an area that might be circling a building before going in two or three times. The system would be able to identify that kind of suspicious activity. And so it would give us potentially the opportunity to interdict earlier on by identifying something that seems not quite right.
Who's going to be monitoring your data?
You know, the cameras are going to be monitored several ways. Each of the city's sister agencies, such as the Mass Transit, Aviation Department, public schools, all have their own monitoring center. But they're going to be aided by a centralized monitoring center at the city's Office of Emergency Management, where we will have teams of individuals specially trained to identify and look for suspicious behavior who will also be monitoring the cameras.
What kind of suspicious behavior, other than loitering or leaving a package, will they also be on the lookout for?
You know, the one of the things that we did as a city is we went and we looked at how London did just what you're talking about, look for suspicious behavior, how Las Vegas looks at casino and how they watch all the cameras. And we realized that to monitor over 2,000 cameras is a huge challenge, and we could never build up the workforce needed to watch all of them. So the software that we introduced is going to enable us to focus on behavior that is suspicious. So, for example, if you had two people walking down the street in opposite directions, and all of a sudden their bodies connected and they started to leave in the same direction, that might show that someone was just grabbed and is being pulled in a direction.
It could also show somebody's going and has met up with a friend and is going to lunch.
Absolutely. And what that would allow then is for an operator to take a quick glance at that image and say, okay, clearly the people are smiling, they're walking down the street, there doesn't appear to be anything out of the ordinary, and then they would just move on to the next image. But it allows us to at least identify, given the totality of cameras, what are the images that might suggest that something might be wrong.
Have you heard from people in Chicago? Have they expressed any concerns?
You know, some people have expressed concern, but really the overwhelming response we have gotten as a city has been very, very positive. Really, our challenge is to deliver more cameras in a shorter time frame as communities and neighborhoods are asking, please include us. We want cameras in our neighborhood.
We're joined by Devin in Salt Lake City. Hi, welcome to the program, Devin.
Thank you.
You have a question?
I do. My question is that being on a closed system and being run by a computer, it seems like, you know, daily computers come up for attack through hackers and other things. What's to keep a terrorist group or someone that wants to do harm entering in, changing the algorithm to get whatever they want? I don't understand how this is an extra level of security from a sophisticated enemy.
Can you explain that to us, Mr. Huberman?
You know, I sure can. It's a great question, Devin. The technology that we apply, the firewalls, the security systems, and we, as a matter of policy, never discuss in details the security because we wouldn't want someone to be able to defeat it, is very sophisticated. And it's actually run on fiber that's on a private proprietary network that's not on a public network, which means the potential for someone to be able to successfully break into this network is very, very difficult. And we feel confident that it is a secure system and that we can control not only the software that drives it, but the individuals who are watching it.
Ron Huberman's the executive director of the Chicago Office of Emergency Management and Communications, which is running the city's new unified camera network. Thanks a lot, Mr. Huberman.
Thank you.
Chicago's new system does have its roots across the Atlantic in the advanced closed circuit television, or its CCTV system as it's known in the United Kingdom. And the UK has embraced public surveillance to the extent that its experts estimate the average Briton is photographed 300 times a day. But how effective is it? Well, joining us now is the man whose job it is to figure that out. Professor Martin Gill is a professor of criminology at the University of Leicester's Scarman Center. Welcome, Professor Gill.
It's good afternoon there, isn't it?
It's good afternoon.
Here.
Good evening to you, sir. Well, with so many cameras, the British government, does it actually know if anything is being prevented?
Well, we certainly know that some crime is being prevented. But how much of that is due to CCTV and how much is due to other things that are going on at the same time remains an open question. We're in the process now of concluding a national evaluation of CCTV, which I'm conducting, is due to report later this year. And that should be able to offer some definitive answers to just whether CCTV is effective or not effective.
Do you have any clues?
Yeah, I can't give you any clues as to our findings because we haven't reported those yet. But if you look at all the research that's been done around the world and you look at the studies that are best at predicting this, and that, by that I mean that have been done properly, because there's an awful amount of studies that have shown CCTV effective but haven't been done properly, then I'm afraid the conclusion is that sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't and sometimes it makes things worse.
Makes things worse? How?
Yeah, well, in this sense, I mean, that crime can be seen to have increased as a consequence of having CCTV, and that may be because more crime has been reported. But in some cases, it's made it worse in this sense, that cameras have been damaged, that some people argue that it's made it worse because people are now relying on cameras to do the job that the citizens would have done for one another previously.
We're joined by Sarah from Pleasanton, California. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, how are you?
Good. I wanted to tell you that I lived in England for about 6 years, and you realize that the whole country is pretty much wired, and it didn't really bother me that much. And the other thing is, while I lived there, they had some cases that were solved with CCTV. And I think that it's a really good idea.
Professor Gill, what about Sarah's point? Do people think it's a great idea?
Well, the British public seem to love it. Surveys that have been done have suggested that as many as 90% over that, in fact, in some cases, are very happy with CCTV. But here's where we just need to be careful. Up until now, that's been done on very limited knowledge about what CCTV can do. What we've just done is interviewed 4,000 members of the British public before CCTV was introduced in areas and then again afterwards. And so what we'll hopefully be able to do is tell you what their experience is and what their views of CCTV are on the back of that experience. And it'll be interesting to see whether it's changed on the back of being more aware of what it can do and what it can't do.
Well, I was intrigued by something you said. People seem to like it, but crime may seem to go up. Is anything actually being deterred?
Yeah, I think it is. First and foremost, the research that's been done is slightly more positive about the effects of CCTV in car parks. What I've been doing is looking at CCTV in residential areas. That's become quite common now in the UK. I've also spent a lot of time in prisons talking to offenders, getting their views of CCTV. And it's a rather mixed reception from them. A lot of them said they committed their crimes impulsively and so weren't really thinking about any consequences, so CCTV wouldn't have deterred them. Others said that you've always got to watch out for someone watching you because they're a potential witness, so you're always alert to anything watching you. But there's one group of people in prison who said they were put off by CCTV, and that was those who'd been caught on camera once already. That suggests that the long-term future is slightly more optimistic.
How do you ask this kind of question? What do you say to people?
In prison, you mean?
Prisoners, yes.
Well, I held a focus group discussion. That's a group of murderers, people serving a life sentence, because I wanted to know whether CCTV would have affected their offences. My view was that if you could stop that sort of crime, then that would be a real endorsement of the methodology. But unfortunately, they gave the same sort of answers, that a lot of them committed their crimes impulsively, so they weren't thinking about the consequences. Although one guy was arrested because his offence was captured on camera, and he was outraged at what he'd done. He'd gone into a liquor licence to steal some spirits, and was stopped by the attendant, and he hit him across the head with a bottle and killed him, and he couldn't believe what he'd done. So it did help capture him. It did make him realize the enormity of his offense.
What about fighting terrorism, preventing, for example, action by the IRA?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, CCTV has been successful there, and it isn't just a matter of deterring someone or catching them in the act. There's all sorts of other ways it can be used. For example, if they catch someone at a particular scene and can trace him back to points where they could collect his fingerprints, for example, or where they can perhaps not get his absolute identity in terms of his facial features, but can find out what he was wearing. And then you can see who else was wearing at other points, wearing the same clothes, at other points in the area where you've got images. And so you can begin to build up pictures that way. But there is one big lesson here that shouldn't be underestimated.
Well, I'm going to ask you to hold that for just a moment, right, Professor. We're talking about living with security cameras in our public spaces. If you have questions about their effectiveness, call us, 1-800-989-TALK. I'm Korva Coleman. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington. Our topic, public surveillance cameras, how the technology is evolving, and what the legal and societal implications are. I am joined by Professor Martin Gill, a professor of criminology at the University of Leicester's Scarman Center. Professor, is there any research to your knowledge in the United States about their effectiveness?
Oh, yes, there's some research in the United States, and some of it says that CCTV is effective. For example, you have CCTV in public buildings there, in apartment blocks, and that's been shown to be successful. But there isn't much research, and what's really missing is research which explains why it works and why it sometimes doesn't, because when you know the why, it enables you to develop good practice. I'm afraid the research on that across the world hasn't been very conclusive, and that's what we're trying to address here.
I have an email here from Ian Pugh who writes, recently my dad took a trip to a small town in England where they use webcams as a form of surveillance cameras. Due to the time difference, he writes, I was unable to talk to him, but I did catch a glimpse of him waving at me over the internet. Do people communicate that way?
Not to my knowledge. That's a new way of doing things. But of course, technology is developing very fast, and the real test for the future is not the technology that's going to be brilliant. It's going to be about how humans interact with it. And that's going to be the real test of how surveillance goes in the future.
I have one more email for you, Professor, from Eric Brunson, who grew up in England, and he says he thinks that the British have a much lower expectation of a right to privacy in that they're willing to allow unannounced inspections of their homes if they have a registered firearm. Do you find this a supportable observation?
Yes, I think that's probably right, actually, and it's probably one of the main reasons why Britain, not alone in the world, but certainly in the minority around the world, is able to embrace this technology with open arms. But one caveat I would add is that it'll be interesting to see whether they have the same view on the back of experience.
Thanks so much for being with us, Professor.
Thank you.
Martin Gill is the Director of Perpetuity Research and Consultancy International, which is associated with the University of Leicester. He joined us from Wolverhampton, England. The technology behind these cameras seems to move at the speed of science fiction, from software that identifies suspicious images to biometrics that can recognize your face or your walk. Sometimes it's hard to know what is being used today to stop crime, at least for now. So with us to explain the state of the art is Andrea Gurrell, the editor of the trade publication Security Director News. And she joins us from their offices in Yarmouth, Maine. Ms. Gurrell, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
So what's revolutionary is the software behind these video cameras, isn't that so?
That's right. Before, with cameras, we saw cameras that could detect motion, and at that point they would turn on and start showing the people behind the monitor what the camera was seeing. Now we actually have cameras with software that can analyze what it's being seen, process it, run it through a database, and through a set of pre-populated behavioral parameters, let the operator know whether or not that's something they should be aware of or take action to correct.
Are cameras also changing in addition to the software technology?
They are. We have today a real transition from your old analog security cameras.
Mm-hmm.
Now everything is going digital, and that's what's really enabling this.
We're joined by Sean from Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi, Sean.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Do you have a question?
It's just a comment. Living in Las Vegas, of course, you walk into casinos, you've got 100 eyes on you at all times, which is kind of an eerie feeling. And then on the top of the intersections, there's cameras on every intersection. And a couple of weeks ago, I didn't really like it, but a couple of weeks ago, I was involved in a hit-and-run accident where somebody hit a friend of mine's car and they took off. And within 20 minutes, they found them. And there's hardly any police cars running around Las Vegas.
Do you find that this is common, Ms. Gurrell, that people can actually find, well, I'm sure it wasn't very exciting for Sean, but more of a petty crime rather than a major crime, that cameras are useful?
Well, sure. A lot of turnpike authorities or, city transportation departments are using cameras not just for security but to monitor traffic flow, things like that. So in this instance, security becomes a real sort of a multitasking operation.
The last time we did this story, everybody was talking about the use of facial recognition technology at the Super Bowl. Do you find that that is in widespread use these days?
In certain instances, it is. A lot of airports are adopting that. A lot of the casinos are doing that as well. They're looking for gamblers who have been found cheating and who are now no longer allowed to enter the casino, things like that. It's also used in sort of the corporate sector, not so much, but as far as access control into a building, things like that, for real high security applications.
So who tends to apply this technology first? The private sector? The public sector? Is the public sector interested in it but waits to see what happens in the private sector?
Well, it's interesting because in years past, I think everyone looked toward mostly to the federal government, but also to state governments and things like that, other agencies, to really be the first adopters for technology like this. A lot of it actually, some of it does come out of the military, but I think with all the liability issues today and also other security concerns, the private sector has really stepped up to the plate and said, yeah, we'll try that out. So I think it's a little bit of a flip-flop.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Andrea Garrell is the editor of Security Director News, a trade publication for the security sector. She joined us from her office in Yarmouth, Maine. The more tasks the government can ask of surveillance cameras, the more questions there are about their legal and social impact. Daniel Solove is a professor of privacy law at George Washington University, and he joins me now from his home in Washington. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, Kate, let's begin at the beginning. I walked out my door this morning. Am I fair game?
Well, unfortunately, we really don't have an adequate system of regulation for public video surveillance in the United States. When it comes to government surveillance of people's activities, the general rule is if you're out in public, you are fair game. The Supreme Court has said that the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution doesn't apply at all when the government engages in public video surveillance. And there's also a set of federal laws that regulate surveillance, but these laws mainly concern forms of audio surveillance and internet surveillance, but they don't apply to video surveillance in the public.
How is it that surveillance cameras can be regulated then?
Well, what we would really need is a set of specific laws that would address the issue. One thing about our system of government is that it consists of three branches, each that has checks and balances over the other. We have the legislative branch, the judiciary, and the executive, and power separated in between these different branches, and the idea is that this prevents branches from abusing their power because other branches are there to check them and stop them. But with the current state of affairs, we really don't have adequate judicial oversight of the use of the cameras, and we don't have adequate legislative oversight of public surveillance cameras. And this is very troubling because that lets the executive branch pretty much do what it wants to do without much accountability and any kind of limitations put on it by the other branches. It gives, I think, the executive far too much power.
We're joined by Joseph in Palisade, Colorado. Hi, Joseph.
Hello. How are you doing, sir?
I'm great. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you. I'm also very pleased to say that, Ms. Coleman, I'm very excited about the fact that I can sit here in my office and work and listen to the radio and in this wonderful nation be able to sit there and come right on the public access directly.
Well, great. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. I've installed, I'm a security contractor in many in California, and I've installed a number of systems, both private and public, both prisons, jails, municipalities, and private companies. My question to Dr. Solove is the activation between when we cross the street, we're in public territory, when we cross the threshold of a business and or a casino, we're in private territory. When you cross a home or privacy of another individual's home, we're obviously in a private indication there. The indication I have is there's a question of surveillance rights and when cameras should be shut off versus when we actually have the right to be monitored. And I'll gladly take my answer on here.
Thanks a lot. Professor?
Well, you ask a very good question. First of all, we have different rules that govern when the government is watching under the surveillance cameras versus when private parties are watching under surveillance cameras. There actually are a few cases where people who have obsessively engaged in surveillance in public of others have, in fact, been held to be liable to those parties. But those cases are generally very rare. And the general rule is if you are in a private setting in certain cases and certain kinds of surveillance in those settings will trigger civil liability for a private party. When it comes to the government, when you're in your home or when you're in a private area, the rules shift then and you actually do get Fourth Amendment protection. But the issue is what happens when you step out onto the street, when you step out into a mall, when you go into a various public area, and is there any difference between just being caught occasionally on tape here and there versus a more pervasive system like the one proposed in Chicago and like the one in Great Britain, where everywhere you go, you're going to be captured on a camera.
Well, does the public have the right to know where the cameras are?
Well, I think the public has to have some sort of rights. In particular, I think the issues we need to be thinking about are how will people be monitored? Will minorities be unfairly singled out in the monitoring, something that has actually happened in Britain? How long will the surveillance videos be kept? How will it be analyzed? Who will get to see it?
But is there existing law that requires the government to do this?
Not a whole lot of regulation when it comes to the video surveillance. So there's potentially the Privacy Act, which would regulate information maintained by the federal government, but when it's state governments, that act wouldn't apply to state governments.
Okay, let's go to Joe in Detroit. Hi, Joe. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In fact, I'm speaking to this gentleman right now. His main comment about the being unfairly focused on. I'm a 6'4" African American male,
mm-hmm.
and I'm about 210 pounds. And I tend to go to stores and I tend to draw a crowd from security, either by the security surveillance system or by the actual persons walking around, following me around. And I tend to do a lot of comparative shopping. Like if I'm in a store, I'll look and see how much this drill costs and how well that works compared to another one or whatever. And sort of my question to you is, how can these systems differentiate my perhaps back-and-forth movement and so forth, or from my race, from any other person who might be doing the same thing?
Professor?
And I'll be taking and I don't mind taking my answer off the air, please.
Okay, Joe. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, the issue there is it really is a technological issue. Some cameras are some of the software proposed in the Chicago system supposedly, and I don't quite know the specifics of how it works, supposedly is designed to detect unusual things. What those actually are, what type of things will trigger the watchers of the camera to send out police officers is a highly subjective issue. And one of the issues that I was talking about with the accountability issue, which is unless we have regulation making sure that the way the cameras are used is a way that's accountable, that the public can understand who are making the decisions and why, we do run the risk that the use of the cameras could be used in potentially discriminatory and stereotypical ways, which could be very problematic. And unless there's accountability, there is very little way that you can have the public to say, wait a second, do we really approve of the way this is being used?
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. We're joined by Nathan in Detroit, Michigan as well. Hi, Nathan.
Hi there.
Welcome to Talk of the Nation. Do you have a question?
Yes, thank you. I do a lot of work with state governments, actually, and I'm wondering, really, I write the privacy is, in my mind, to the extent where we give people the privilege to, for us to not have privacy. And as the current panel member mentioned, that state government and federal government are legislated and controlled differently. Department of Transportation in states right now, for example, in many states are tracking with algorithms license plates from beginning of the state to the end of the state. under the premise of monitoring traffic flow. As we start to see these, not just law enforcement, but multiple different agencies implement these technologies, what is on the horizon right now for controlling that or passing laws about not consolidating that data? Because it's really meaningless data in and of itself, but once you get all these different points put together and collect the data into one, then it has much more meaningful, it's much more meaningful to the people that might want to misuse it.
I think you make a wonderful point, actually, and a point that really should be well taken, and that is how do we prevent the data from downstream uses? How do we prevent the fact that someone takes an image here and an image there and video footage from here and video footage from there and combines it to paint a more accurate picture of what a person did, not just in a particular place, but throughout their entire day, everywhere they've ever went, everything they've ever done, filmed in 24/7 fashion. And this is not completely far-fetched because it is easy to store digital information these days, and there are technologies such as facial recognition technology and other kind of biometric identification that can pick people up based on their gait or the way they walk that can, in fact, analyze video and try to identify people involved. And there are dangers because this software isn't entirely accurate, but there's also dangers if it, to the extent that it is accurate or becomes more accurate, that it will be increasingly able to assemble this information about a particular person that the government might be interested in investigating.
Okay, let's jump to CJ in Anchorage. Hello, CJ.
Hello. I just wanted a brief comment here, but we've been using webcams to communicate up here in Alaska for quite a while. I'm formerly from Valdez, and there are webcams in Anchorage all over, and we would arrange, it's a 350-mile trip, we would arrange to be under the camera and online at a certain time, and we could signal each other or, you know, to call at a certain time, or I made the trip successfully. Just wanted to let you know that webcams are used to communicate.
All right. Thanks a lot, CJ. Professor, are we going to see a lot more of this? And is it okay just to kind of wave at people? It's like sort of like holding up a big sign that says, "Hi, Mom," at the Super Bowl.
Well, I do unfortunately see this development, and I think it's alarming that we're seeing more and more attempts to use the surveillance cameras. And I think that on the innocuous side, people might wave to the cameras, but I think on the more pernicious side, there's a lot of questions about how accountable the users of these cameras will be, who's going to watch the watchers, and what kind of regulation are we really going to put in place to ensure that there aren't abuses of the cameras.
Thanks so much for joining us. Professor Daniel Soloff teaches privacy law at George Washington University. His forthcoming book is The Digital Person, Technology and Privacy in the Information Age. Thanks, Professor.